sleeping under hedges and behind ricks in preference. Along the south coast he had begged by day and slept in bathing huts for weeks at a time. We talked of life on the road. He criticised the system that makes a tramp spend 14 hours a day in the spike and the other 10 in walking and dodging the police. He spoke of his own case. 6 months at the public charge for want of a few pounds worth of tools. It was idiotic, he said. Then I told him about the wastage of food in the workhouse kitchen and what I thought of it. And at that he changed his tone instantly. I saw that I had awakened the pew renter who sleeps in every English workman. Though he had been famished along with the others, he at once saw reasons why the food should have been thrown away rather than given to the tramps. He admonished me quite severely. They have to do it, he said. If they made these places too comfortable, you'd have all the scum of the country flocking into them. It's only the bad food as keeps all that scum away. These here tramps are too lazy to work. That's all that's wrong with them. You don't want to go encouraging of them. They're scum. I produced arguments to prove him wrong, but he would not listen. He kept repeating, "You don't want to have any pity on these here tramps. Scum they are. You don't want to judge them by the same standards as men like you and me. They're scum. Just scum." It was interesting to see the subtle way in which he disassociated himself from these here tramps. He had been on the road 6 months, but in the sight of God he seemed to imply he was not a tramp. I imagine there are quite a lot of tramps who thank God they're not tramps. They're like the trippers who say such cutting things about trippers. 3 hours dragged by. At 6, supper arrived, and turned out to be quite uneatable. The bread, tough enough in the morning, it had been cut into slices on Saturday night, was now as hard as ship's biscuit. Luckily it was spread with dripping, and we scraped the dripping off and ate that alone, which was better than nothing. At 6:15, we were sent to bed. New tramps were arriving, and in order not to mix the tramps of different days, for fear of infectious diseases, the new men were put in the cells, and we in dormitories. Our dormitory was a barn-like room with 30 beds close together, and a tub to serve as a common chamber pot. It stank abominably, and the older men coughed and got up all night. But being so many together kept the room warm, and we had some sleep. We dispersed at 10 in the morning, after a fresh medical inspection, with a hunk of bread and cheese for our midday dinner. William and Fred, strong in the possession of a shilling, impaled their bread on the spike railings, as a protest, they said. This was the second spike in Kent that they had made too hot to hold them, and they thought it a great joke. They were cheerful souls for tramps. The imbecile, there is an imbecile in every collection of tramps, said that he was too tired to walk and clung to the railings, until the tramp major had to dislodge him and start him with a kick. Paddy and I turned north for London. Most of the others were going on to Hyde Hill, said to be about the worst spike in England. I have been in it since, and it isn't so bad. Once again it was jolly autumn weather, and the road was quiet, with few cars passing. The air was like sweetbriar after the spike's mingled stenches of sweat, soap and drains. We two seemed the only tramps on the road. Then I heard a hurried step behind us and someone calling. It was little Scotty, the Glasgow tramp, who had run after us, panting. He produced a rusty tin from his pocket. He wore a friendly smile, like someone repaying an obligation. "Here you are, mate," he said cordially. "I owe you some faggins. You stood me a smoke yesterday. The tramp major gave me back my box of faggins when we come out this morning. One good ton deserves another. Here you are." And he put 4 sodden, debauched, loathly cigarette ends into my hand. Chapter 36. I want to set down some general remarks about tramps. When one comes to think of it, tramps are a queer product and worth thinking over. It's queer that a tribe of men, tens of thousands in number, should be marching up and down England like so many wandering Jews. But though the case obviously wants considering, one cannot even start to consider it until one has got rid of certain prejudices. These prejudices are rooted in the idea that every tramp, ipso facto, is a blackguard. In childhood, we have been taught that tramps are blackguards, and consequently there exists in our minds a sort of ideal or typical tramp, a repulsive, rather dangerous creature, who would die rather than work or wash, and wants nothing but to beg, drink, and rob hen houses. This tramp monster is no truer to life than the sinister Chinaman of the magazine stories, but he's very hard to get rid of. The very word tramp evokes his image, and the belief in him obscures the real questions of vagrancy. To take a fundamental question about vagrancy, why do tramps exist at all? It is a curious thing, but very few people know what makes a tramp take to the road, and because of the belief in the tramp monster, the most fantastic reasons are suggested. It is said, for instance, that tramps tramp to avoid work, to beg more easily, to seek opportunities for crime even, least probable of reasons, because they like tramping. I have even read in a book of criminology that the tramp is an atavism, a throwback to the nomadic stage of humanity, and meanwhile the quite obvious cause of vagrancy is staring one in the face. Of course a tramp is not a nomadic atavism. One might as well say that a commercial traveller is an atavism. A tramp tramps, not because he likes it, but for the same reason as a car keeps to the left, because there happens to be a law compelling him to do so. A destitute man, if he is not supported by the parish, can only get relief at the casual wards. And as each casual ward will only admit him for one night, he is automatically kept moving. He is a vagrant because, in the state of the law, it is that or starve. But people have been brought up to believe in the tramp monster, and so they prefer to think that there must be some more or less villainous motive for tramping. As a matter of fact, very little of the tramp monster will survive inquiry. Take the generally accepted idea that tramps are dangerous characters. Quite apart from experience, one can say a priori that very few tramps are dangerous, because if they were dangerous, they would be treated accordingly. A casual ward will often admit 100 tramps in one night, and these are handled by a staff of, at most, 3 porters. 100 ruffians could not be controlled by 3 unarmed men. Indeed, when one sees how tramps let themselves be bullied by the workhouse officials, it is obvious that they are the most docile, broken-spirited creatures imaginable. Or take the idea that all tramps are drunkards, an idea ridiculous on the face of it. No doubt many tramps would drink, if they got the chance, but in the nature of things they cannot get the chance. At this moment, a pale, watery stuff called beer is 7 pence a pint in England. To be drunk on it would cost at least 0.5 crown. And a man who can command 0.5 crown at all often is not a tramp. The idea that tramps are impudent social parasites, sturdy beggars, is not absolutely unfounded, but it's only true in a few percent of the cases. Deliberate, cynical parasitism, such as one reads of in Jack London's books on American tramping, is not in the English character. The English are a conscience-ridden race with a strong sense of the sinfulness of poverty. One cannot imagine the average Englishman deliberately turning parasite, and this national character does not necessarily change because a man is thrown out of work. Indeed, if one remembers that a tramp is only an Englishman out of work, forced by law to live as a vagabond, then the tramp monster vanishes. I'm not saying, of course, that most tramps are ideal characters. I'm only saying that they are ordinary human beings, and that if they're worse than other people, it is the result and not the cause of their way of life. It follows that the serve-them-damned-well-right attitude that is normally taken towards tramps is no fairer than it would be towards cripples or invalids. When one has realised that, one begins to put oneself in a tramp's place and understand what his life is like. It is an extraordinarily futile, acutely unpleasant life. I've described the casual ward, the routine of a tramp's day, but there are 3 especial evils that need insisting upon. The first is hunger, which is the almost general fate of tramps. The casual ward gives them a ration which is probably not even meant to be sufficient, and anything beyond this must be got by begging. That is, by breaking the law. The result is that nearly every tramp is rotted by malnutrition. For proof of which, one need only look at the men lining up outside any casual ward. The second great evil of a tramp's life, it seems much smaller at first sight, but it is a good second, is that he is entirely cut off from contact with women. This point needs elaborating. Tramps are cut off from women in the first place because there are very few women at their level of society. One might imagine that among destitute people the sexes would be as equally balanced as elsewhere, but it is not so. In fact, one can almost say that below a certain level society is entirely male. The following figures, published by the London County Council from a night census taken on February 13, 1931, will show the relative numbers of destitute men and destitute women. Spending the night in the streets, 60 men, 18 women. This must be an underestimate. Still, the proportions probably hold good. In shelters and homes not licensed as common lodging houses, 1,057 men, 137 women. In the crypt of St. Martin's in the Fields Church, 88 men, 12 women. In London County Council casual wards and hostels, 674 men, 15 women. It will be seen from these figures that at the charity level, men outnumber women by something like 10 to 1. The cause is presumably that unemployment affects women less than men, also that any presentable woman can, in the last resort, attach herself to some man. The result, for a tramp, is that he is condemned to perpetual celibacy. For of course it goes without saying that if a tramp finds no women at his own level, those above, even a very little above, are as far out of his reach as the moon. The reasons are not worth discussing, but there is no doubt that women never, or hardly ever, condescend to men who are much poorer than themselves. A tramp, therefore, is a celibate from the moment when he takes to the road. He is absolutely without hope of getting a wife, a mistress, or any kind of woman, except, very rarely, when he can raise a few shillings, a prostitute. It's obvious what the results of this must be. Homosexuality, for instance, and occasional rape cases. But deeper than these, there is the degradation worked in a man who knows that he is not even considered fit for marriage. The sexual impulse, not to put it any higher, is a fundamental impulse, and starvation of it can be almost as demoralizing as physical hunger. The evil of poverty is not so much that it makes a man suffer, as that it rots him physically and spiritually. And there can be no doubt that sexual starvation contributes to this rotting process. Cut off from the whole race of women, a tramp feels himself degraded to the rank of a cripple or a lunatic. No humiliation could do more damage to a man's self-respect. The other great evil of a tramp's life is enforced idleness. By our vagrancy laws, things are so arranged that when he's not walking the road, he's sitting in a cell, or in the intervals lying on the ground waiting for the casual ward to open. It is obvious that this is a dismal, demoralizing way of life, especially for an uneducated man. Besides these, one could enumerate scores of minor evils. To name only one, discomfort, which is inseparable from life on the road. It's worth remembering that the average tramp has no clothes but what he stands up in, wears boots that are ill-fitting, and doesn't sit in a chair for months together. But the important point is that a tramp's sufferings are entirely useless. He lives a fantastically disagreeable life and lives it to no purpose whatever. One could not, in fact, invent a more futile routine than walking from prison to prison, spending perhaps 18 hours a day in the cell and on the road. There must be at the least several tens of thousands of tramps in England. Each day they expend innumerable foot-pounds of energy, enough to plough thousands of acres, build miles of road, put up dozens of houses, in mere useless walking. Each day they waste between them possibly 10 years of time in staring at cell walls. They cost the country at least £1 a week a man, and give nothing in return for it. They go round and round on an endless, boring game of general post, which is of no use, and isn't even meant to be of any use to any person whatever. The law keeps this process going, and we have got so accustomed to it that we're not surprised. But it is very silly. Granting the futility of a tramp's life, the question is whether anything could be done to improve it. Obviously, it would be possible, for instance, to make the casual wards a little more habitable, and this is actually being done in some cases. During the last year, some of the casual wards have been improved beyond recognition, if the accounts are true, and there is talk of doing the same to all of them. But this doesn't go to the heart of the problem. The problem is how to turn the tramp from a bored, half-alive vagrant into a self-respecting human being. A mere increase of comfort cannot do this. Even if the casual wards became positively luxurious, and they never will, in fairness it must be added that a few of the casual wards have been improved recently, at least from the point of view of sleeping accommodation, but most of them are the same as ever, and there has been no real improvement in the food, a tramp's life would still be wasted. He would still be a pauper, cut off from marriage and home life, and a dead loss to the community. What is needed is to depauperise him. And this can only be done by finding him work. Not work for the sake of working, but work of which he can enjoy the benefit. At present, in the great majority of casual wards, tramps do no work whatever. At one time they were made to break stones for their food, but this was stopped when they'd broken enough stone for years ahead and put the stone breakers out of work. Nowadays they're kept idle, because there is seemingly nothing for them to do. Yet there is a fairly obvious way of making them useful, namely this. Each workhouse could run a small farm, or at least a kitchen garden, and every able-bodied tramp who presented himself could be made to do a sound day's work. The produce of the farm or garden could be used for feeding the tramps, and at the worst it would be better than the filthy diet of bread and margarine and tea. Of course, the casual wards could never be quite self-supporting, but they could go a long way towards it, and the rates would probably benefit in the long run. It must be remembered that under the present system, tramps are as dead a loss to the country as they could possibly be, for they do not only do no work, but they live on a diet that is bound to undermine their health. The system, therefore, loses lives as well as money. A scheme which fed them decently and made them produce at least a part of their own food would be worth trying. It may be objected that a farm or even a garden could not be run with casual labour, but there is no real reason why tramps should only stay a day at each casual ward. They might stay a month, or even a year, if there were work for them to do. The constant circulation of tramps is something quite artificial. At present, a tramp is an expense to the rates, and the object of each workhouse is therefore to push him on to the next. Hence the rule that he can stay only one night. If he returns within a month, he is penalised by being confined for a week, and, as this is much the same as being in prison, naturally he keeps moving. But if he represented labour to the workhouse, and the workhouse represented sound food to him, it would be another matter. The workhouses would develop into partially self-supporting institutions, and the tramps, settling down here or there according as they were needed, would cease to be tramps. They would be doing something comparatively useful, getting decent food, and living a settled life. By degrees, if the scheme worked well, they might even cease to be regarded as paupers, and be able to marry and take a respectable place in society. This is only a rough idea, and there are some obvious objections to it. Nevertheless, it does suggest a way of improving the status of tramps without piling new burdens on the rates, and the solution must in any case be something of this kind, for the question is what to do with men who are underfed and idle, and the answer, to make them grow their own food, imposes itself automatically. Chapter 37. A word about the sleeping accommodation open to a homeless person in London. At present, it is impossible to get a bed in any non-charitable institution in London for less than sevenpence a night. If you cannot afford sevenpence for a bed, you must put up with one of the following substitutes. 1. The embankment. Here is the account that Paddy gave me of sleeping on the embankment. The whole thing with the embankment is getting to sleep early. You got to be on your bench by 8 o'clock, because there aren't too many benches, and sometimes they're all taken. And you got to try to get to sleep at once. 'Tis too cold to sleep much after 12 o'clock, and the police turns you off at 4 in the morning. It ain't easy to sleep, though, with them bloody trams flying past your head all the time, and them sky signs across the river flicking on and off in your eyes. The cold's cruel. Them as sleeps there generally wraps themselves up in newspaper, but it don't do much good. You'd be bloody lucky if you got 3 hours' sleep. I have slept on the embankment, and found that it corresponded to Paddy's description. It is, however, much better than not sleeping at all, which is the alternative if you spend the night in the streets, elsewhere than on the embankment. According to the law in London, you may sit down for the night, but the police must move you on if they see you asleep. The embankment, and one or two odd corners, there is one behind the Lyceum Theatre, are special exceptions. This law is evidently a piece of wilful offensiveness. Its object, so it is said, is to prevent people from dying of exposure. But clearly, if a man has no home and is going to die of exposure, die he will, asleep or awake. In Paris there is no such law. There people sleep by the score under the Seine bridges and in doorways and on benches in the squares and round the ventilating shafts of the metro and even inside the metro stations. It does no apparent harm. No one will spend a night in the street if he can possibly help it. And if he's going to stay out of doors, he might as well be allowed to sleep if he can. 2. The Tuppenny Hangover. This comes a little higher than the embankment. At the Tuppenny Hangover, the lodgers sit in a row on a bench. There is a rope in front of them, and they lean on this as though leaning over a fence. A man, humorously called the valet, cuts the rope at 5 in the morning. I have never been there myself, but Bozo had been there often. I asked him whether anyone could possibly sleep in such an attitude, and he said that it was more comfortable than it sounded, at any rate better than the bare floor. There are similar shelters in Paris, but the charge there is only 25 centimes, a halfpenny, instead of tuppence. 3. The Coffin, at 4 pence a night. At the coffin you sleep in a wooden box, with a tarpaulin for covering. It's cold, and the worst thing about it are the bugs, which, being enclosed in a box, you cannot escape. Above this come the common lodging houses, with charges varying between 7 pence and 1 and a penny a night. The best are the Rowton houses, where the charge is 1 shilling, for which you get a cubicle to yourself and the use of excellent bathrooms. You can also pay 0.5 crown for a special, which is practically hotel accommodation. The Rowton houses are splendid buildings, and the only objection to them is the strict discipline, with rules against cooking, card-playing, etc. Perhaps the best advertisement for the Rowton houses is the fact that they are always full to overflowing. The Bruce houses at 1 and a penny are also excellent. Next best, in point of cleanliness, are the Salvation Army hostels, at 7 pence or 8 pence. They vary. I've been in 1 or 2 that were not very unlike common lodging houses, but most of them are clean and they have good bathrooms. You have to pay extra for a bath, however. You can get a cubicle for 1 shilling. In the 8-penny dormitories, the beds are comfortable, but there are so many of them, as a rule at least 40 to a room, and so close together that it's impossible to get a quiet night. The numerous restrictions stink of prison and charity. The Salvation Army hostels would only appeal to people who put cleanliness before anything else. Beyond this are the ordinary common lodging houses. Whether you pay 7 pence or 1 shilling, they are all stuffy and noisy, and the beds are uniformly dirty and uncomfortable. What redeems them are their laissez-faire atmosphere and the warm home-like kitchens, where one can lounge at all hours of the day or night. They are squalid dens, but some kind of social life is possible in them. The women's lodging houses are said to be generally worse than the men's, and there are very few houses with accommodation for married couples. In fact, it's nothing out of the common for a homeless man to sleep in one lodging house and his wife in another. At this moment, at least 15,000 people in London are living in common lodging houses. For an unattached man, earning £2 a week or less, a lodging house is a great convenience. He could hardly get a furnished room so cheaply, and the lodging house gives him free firing, a bathroom of sorts, and plenty of society. As for the dirt, it's a minor evil. The really bad fault of lodging houses is that they are places in which one pays to sleep, and in which sound sleep is impossible. All one gets for one's money is a bed measuring 5 feet 6 by 2 feet 6, with a hard convex mattress and a pillow like a block of wood, covered by one cotton counterpane and 2 grey stinking sheets. In winter there are blankets, but never enough, and this bed is in a room where there are never less than 5, and sometimes 50 or 60 beds, a yard or 2 apart. Of course no one can sleep soundly in such circumstances. The only other places where people are herded like this are barracks and hospitals. In the public wards of a hospital no one even hopes to sleep well. In barracks the soldiers are crowded, but they have good beds, and they're healthy. In a common lodging house, nearly all the lodgers have chronic coughs, and a large number have bladder diseases which make them get up at all the hours of the night. The result is a perpetual racket, making sleep impossible. So far as my observation goes, no one in a lodging house sleeps more than 5 hours a night. A damnable swindle when one has paid sevenpence or more. Here, legislation could accomplish something. At present, there is all manner of legislation by the London County Council about lodging houses, but it is not done in the interests of the lodgers. The LCC only exert themselves to forbid drinking, gambling, fighting, etc., etc. There is no law to say that the beds in a lodging house must be comfortable. This would be quite an easy thing to enforce, much easier, for instance, than restrictions upon gambling. The lodging house keepers should be compelled to provide adequate bedclothes and better mattresses, and above all to divide their dormitories into cubicles. It doesn't matter how small a cubicle is, the important thing is that a man should be alone when he sleeps. These few changes, strictly enforced, would make an enormous difference. It's not impossible to make a lodging house reasonably comfortable at the usual rates of payment. In the Croydon Municipal Lodging House, where the charge is only 9p, there are cubicles, good beds, chairs, a very rare luxury in lodging houses, and kitchens above ground instead of in a cellar. There's no reason why every 9p lodging house should not come up to this standard. Of course, the owners of lodging houses would be opposed en bloc to any improvement, for their present business is an immensely profitable one. The average house takes £5 or £10 a night, with no bad debts, credit being strictly forbidden, and except for rent, the expenses are small. Any improvement would mean less crowding, and hence less profit. Still, the excellent municipal lodging house at Croydon shows how well one can be served for 9p. A few well-directed laws could make these conditions general. If the authorities are going to concern themselves with lodging houses at all, they ought to start by making them more comfortable, not by silly restrictions that would never be tolerated in an hotel. Chapter 38. After we left the Spike at Lower Binfield, Paddy and I earned 0.5 crown at weeding and sweeping in somebody's garden, stayed the night at Cromley, and walked back to London. I parted from Paddy a day or two later. B lent me a final £2, and as I had only another 8 days to hold out, that was the end of my troubles. My tame imbecile turned out worse than I had expected, but not bad enough to make me wish myself back in the Spike or the Auberge de Jeanne Cottard. Paddy set out for Portsmouth, where he had a friend who might conceivably find work for him, and I've never seen him since. A short time ago I was told that he'd been run over and killed, but perhaps my informant was mixing him up with someone else. I had news of Bozo only 3 days ago. He's in Wandsworth. 14 days for begging. I don't suppose prison worries him very much. My story ends here. It is a fairly trivial story, and I can only hope that it's been interesting in the same way as a travel diary is interesting. I can at least say, here is the world that awaits you if you're ever penniless. Someday I want to explore that world more thoroughly. I should like to know people like Mario and Paddy and Bill the Moocher, not from casual encounters, but intimately, I should like to understand what really goes on in the souls of plongeurs and tramps and embankment sleepers. At present, I do not feel that I've seen more than the fringe of poverty. Still, I can point to one or two things I have definitely learned by being hard up. I shall never again think that all tramps are drunken scoundrels, nor expect a beggar to be grateful when I give him a penny, nor be surprised if men out of work lack energy, nor subscribe to the Salvation Army, nor pawn my clothes, nor refuse a handbill, nor enjoy a meal at a smart restaurant. That is a beginning.
The End. You've been listening to Down and Out in Paris and London by George Orwell, narrated by Patrick Tull. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Road to Wigan Pier, also by George Orwell and narrated by Patrick Tull. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com.